All right. You might have just caught a flash of James there as he ducked in front of the camera. We are back and we have lots to do this morning, lots to talk about. There is plenty going on in the news. I just want to start off with a little clip from the President of the United States just yesterday. He stopped to speak to the media on his way to, I don't know whether it was Air Force One or Marine One. The helicopter was on the lawns of the White House. And this is getting a lot of attention for some very obvious reasons. We'll talk about it in just a second, but take a look at this in case you missed it.
They violated it, but Israel violated it too.
Are you questioning if Israel is committed?
Israel, as soon as we made the deal, they came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I've never seen before. The biggest load that we've seen. I'm not happy with Israel. You know, when I say, okay, now you have 12 hours, you don't go out in the first hour and just drop everything you have on them. So I'm not happy with them. I'm not happy with Iran either. But I'm really unhappy if Israel's going out this morning because of one rocket that didn't land, that was shot, perhaps by mistake, that didn't land. I'm not happy about that. You know what? We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the fuck they're doing. Do you understand that?
All right, so obviously a lot of very stupid people are focused on the they don't know what the fuck they're doing part of this. But we've had, in the space of 2.5 weeks, a tremendous amount of behind-the-scenes and in front-of-the-scenes activity, which has changed fundamentally the geopolitical power balance in a part of the world which has been in the headlines, let's face it, and part of Trump going, they don't know what the fuck they're doing, is because all of my adult life, the Middle East has been dominating the headlines. It has been a tinderbox, a fulcrum of international political tension. We've had Israel at the center of some of it. We've had Saudi Arabia and Iran in other parts of it. We've had Syria for a while, Lebanon. I mean, it doesn't seem to stop. And I think we're at the point now where we're looking at a very, very different Middle East to what we would have guessed in anybody's wildest dreams or nightmares might have been the scenario just before October the 7th, 2023. And that's likely as a result of a very big miscalculation on the part of those people who started what they started on October the 7th. I don't need to tell you what my position is on this because we get to talk about it often. But I'm thrilled to have someone here who actually is a lot more expert in so much of what we've discussed on the show over the years. And it's somebody called Brooke Goldstein. Now, you may have seen Brooke already in the media, but she's the founder and executive director of the Lawfare Project, a legal think tank that defends Jewish civil rights worldwide. She also founded the Children's Rights Institute and directed a documentary called The Making of a Martyr. She regularly appears in the media and has authored Lawfare, The War Against Free Speech. So there are so many topics here that are close to my heart. Let's get straight into it. Brooke, it's nice to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And I mean, what a week for news, right?
Yeah.
And you said when we were talking about it just before you sat down, there's a lot of bad info out there.
Correct.
I mean, I'm still waiting for the Ayatollah's, you know, rage tweeting about there's going to be retribution. And I'm still waiting. I think Israel's still waiting, and I think Donald Trump's still waiting. But there's supposedly a ceasefire on at the moment.
Yeah,
Do you think it'll hold?
I love when people are talking about ceasefires with radical Islamist groups whose goal is to establish the caliphate and kill everyone, every last man, woman, and child while doing that.
Yeah,
the mullahs are not going to give up Iran voluntarily. There's also been a lot of misinformation and disinformation intentionally, especially in the weeks leading up to the Israeli attack. There was reports that we know now were false.
But we kind of know that we sort of expect that from Iran, right?
What do you mean?
Well, we expect them to lie and propagandize and spin.
Yeah, but when you're not going to alert, the United States is not going to alert Iran before an attack. And Israel, it was like almost like they were hiding in plain sight, because for months, or if not years, Netanyahu said, we are preparing and we will do everything and we are ready to strike now. And with all that rhetoric, they were actually preparing and getting ready to strike for the right moment. And so when, first of all, Netanyahu's son was supposed to get married the weekend that Israel started the strikes.
Did they put off the wedding?
Yes, they did, if the wedding even existed. I mean, there was just coordination, disinformation, public campaign by the two governments, which was actually very brilliantly done.
Yeah.
They wanted to pretend as though there was daylight between Bibi and
Trump.
Trump. And the truth was the exact opposite, that they were on the same page and they carried out a strategic strike. And the most important part about this is we are not at war with the Iranian people.
Yeah.
The strategic goal of these strikes is to demilitarize and denuclearize the Iranian regime.
I had this exact discussion with someone just yesterday, and I said there are only really two positions on this. It doesn't matter whether you are the pro Ayatollah Khamenei or whether you're pro Benjamin Netanyahu, whether you have sympathies with the situation in the Middle East from any point of view, or you don't. The only question is, do you think it's okay for Iran to have a nuclear weapon, or don't you? And we can take the decision tree from there. We can figure out a whole bunch of stuff after that and get into the nuances of your position. Because some people might have a nuanced position. I don't think many people do. I think for many people it's binary. So start with that binary. Is it okay for Iran to have a nuclear weapon or not?
Look, I'll start with that binary from a Jewish perspective.
Sure.
Okay? If somebody, one thing that we learned from the Holocaust, I remember a Holocaust survivor saying in an interview when he was asked, after everything you've been through, what is the one thing that you've learned and you want to tell future generations? And he said, if someone threatens to kill you, believe him.
Yeah.
And it's that simple.
Yeah, and Iran haven't been hiding the ball.
Iran has time and time again issued threats, not just against Israel, because they see Israel as the little devil in America,
as the big devil.
And, and they've been threatening to annihilate, death to America, death to Israel. At the same time, they are the state sponsor, the number one state sponsor of terrorist groups that are actively going out killing people. They've killed over 1,000 Americans over the last couple of years. And then they are openly developing nuclear enrichment capabilities up to 60%, which is just below weapon grade. They have plenty of oil. They don't need this enrichment. It's clearly for
and
weapons.
They told us what they'll
for
do
civilian,
with it.
Exactly. For
they
civilian
said.
Purposes, is enrichment is between 3 and 5%. Okay, they've told us what they're going to do with it, and they were planning it. They were planning an October 7th times 1,000. They were going to overwhelm Israel under a barrage of rocket attacks from all directions on all of Israel's borders, with trucks and jihadis flooding into Israel. They wanted to do a great flood number two. And Israel saw this and said, we will not tolerate it.
Yeah, while we can, we'll do something about it.
Correct.
Maybe it's also as a result of the fact that Hamas and Hezbollah have so spectacularly failed, and Israel's been so good at dealing with the threat that they posed.
Yeah, and it's a miracle that they failed. It really has everything to do with them and not to us. And
you think so?
There are reports that Hezbollah was supposed to attack together with Hamas, and if there wasn't a Nova festival, if there wasn't all of those beautiful, innocent young people who were martyred that day, the terrorists would have made their way all the way to Tel Aviv, if not more north. I know that two terrorists were caught in Herzliya, which is just north of Tel Aviv. It is a miracle that Hezbollah did not attack at the same time.
Right, so they just couldn't get their act together.
They didn't get their act together. Their attack, as you know, was the largest mass slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust. And that, perspective, it was successful. And frankly, with psychological warfare, I think that they've had some successes. What really bothered me is that, you know, the terrorists had GoPros on their heads for a reason. They wanted to film things. They wanted to upload it.
Yeah.
They have no qualms with what they're doing. This is their version of jihad, and they're very proud of it. Remember that video of the man saying, Dad,
I killed,
the Jew, and them saying, I'm so proud of you. We then took that 47 minutes of footage, repackaged it, and became the film distributor for Hamas. And I understand in certain circumstances when you're dealing with world leaders or you're dealing with members of the police, but we were screening that footage, like, you know, fetishizing the footage of dead, slaughtered Jews for the world to see,
Brooke,
to convince them, look, we deserve to live, we have a right to live.
You know,
and still there was denial.
It is sickening to me that that kind of thing had to be paraded around, that people who filmed it were the perpetrators of that violence, and that somehow for some people in the world that's still not enough. But let me try and be devil's advocate for a second here, because I know you're well prepared to deal with these questions. Let's imagine, as many defenders of Iran are now doing, that Iran was not close to a nuclear weapon. I'm going to put aside all the naivety you need to amass in order to pose and posit this kind of idea of how Iran might work. But let's take the argument that, oh, Iran is just, this is like Iraq with the weapons of mass destruction. You hear this argument quite a lot on the internet from idiots. So how do you refute the claims that maybe Iran wasn't close to a nuclear weapon and Israel just saw a chance to malevolently take out their frustration on a nation that they say is the architect of all of these other jihadi groups of Shiite Muslims around Israel, who are trying to destroy them, and they've got an existential let's call it an imagination of an existential crisis rather than a real one.
Right.
How do you deal with those?
I tend not to try and deal with idiotic hypotheticals. The facts on the ground is that Iran was, they say, at most 3 months away from achieving nuclear weapons. The IAEA released a report just this past June, which is supposed to be the objective world body. It's not this pro-Israel entity, so to speak, saying that Iran had violated the agreements. Iran themselves, it's like the bigotry of low expectations. Oh, those Muslims, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't really mean what they're saying. They mean what they're saying, and they've carried out these activities. The proxies, okay? If Iran right now is taking rockets and bombing hospitals and indiscriminately bombing civilians, what do you think the world would look like if those rocket heads had biological or nuclear or chemical weapons on them? You have to take the leaders of the Iranian state at face value. They're adults. They know exactly what they're doing. And you have to understand the theology behind it. We're dealing not with logical people. We're dealing with theological people who are radical Islamists who believe in reestablishing a caliphate, and they believe that they must kill the infidels, and they must kill the white people, and they must kill black Christians, and they must kill Jews as well, any other minority community. And that's why this threat, and I keep emphasizing this, the threat of radical Islam, the threat of theologically motivated terrorism, what you have on your border with Mozambique with ISIS is the same thing that Israel had on its border with Hamas. It's all the same, and they're all being funded by Iran, and this is factual, and it's provable. And it's being done out in the open. So you have to be completely delusional not to understand that reality.
So what do you think a best case scenario for the Middle East and especially for Israel might be? And what do you think the worst case scenario going forward might be? Because we saw Trump having his little tirade this morning or last night in America. And perhaps he is justifiably upset because this is a very fractious situation we've got there. So as you put it already, you said this couldn't have been more masterfully handled. I tend to agree. I think that from the American point of view, Trump was misdirecting them with things like, oh, you got 2 weeks, and 2 days later he was sending B-2 bombers over there to sort out Fordo and Isfahan and Natanz. And Israel had done an excellent job already the week before by removing all air capabilities over Iran. And basically, you could fly a paraglider over there right now, and you'd be fine.
Yeah, Israel has total control over it. Israel and America.
And Syria, of all places, I mean, Syria, which was run by Assad just a short while ago and did everything it could to make Israel's life a misery. Mm-hmm. Apparently, they said, sure, you can have, you use our skies. Go for it.
Yeah, look how
fly right over.
Everybody fell.
And you know, Saudi Arabia will complain about this after the fact, but they must have been a part of the understanding in the beginning, at very least. We know that the Abraham Accords have got about the closest that we've got to real peace in the area mm-hmm. and a promise of real peace in the area
right.
for the longest
peace
time.
Through economic cooperation, but we're right. also missing peace through the elimination of hate education. Right.
Okay.
One of the things that was necessary for Saudi Arabia, for example, it didn't sign the Abraham Accords, but, you know, it's in talks and it's coming round, was to stop the funding of its Wahhabi influence system within the United States and to revise its curriculum, which Saudi Arabia has done. It's possible. But when you see, you know, millions of Muslims being taught in their schools, in their textbooks, by their television programs, their religious leaders, that they need to engage in a violent jihad and they need to hate Jews and hate the infidels, the future does not look peaceful. And when you have a power vacuum in the Middle East, as we have seen several times over the last, you know, 15 years, one of two things can happen. It can either get better or it can get worse. And the determinators of what's going to happen in Iran is the Iranian people. And you look at the targeted, precise strikes by both the United States and the IDF. They are taking out the nuclear facilities. They're taking out the military capabilities. I think there was also a strike by one of the famous prisons that held the political prisoners to rattle that building and hopefully open the doors. The job now is for the Iranian people to take over. This is not about state building. It's not about imposing democracy. It's about regime change for the people. You know, it's about waiting really into the very last minute, giving Iran every last chance to take back, to make a deal, you know, to stop with its incitement to violence. And when that didn't happen, we took that out and now we're, you know, retracting, and it's up to the Iranian people to decide how to govern their country.
Well, what would for you be the best case scenario going forward? Because we do need some kind of, at least an attempt at permanent change, peace, not just for Iran, but mm-hmm. for the whole region, because there's been such instability. I mean, I don't think anyone has got a plan for Gaza yet. Trump says he's going to turn it into, you know, a resort capital. There is so much that needs to be done now. What do you think Israel's capable of doing? Certainly we know now that the intelligence and military capabilities of Israel have probably been horribly underestimated by Israel's enemies for the longest time. And perhaps we've overestimated the military capabilities of Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. Maybe also we've got to give credit to Israel for having undermined those things at some level. And having been able to counter them, because it's fine to think that your enemy is very powerful, but be able to do nothing about it. What does this leave in the neighborhood in terms of possible green shoots for the future? And what are the areas that probably require the most focus? Because I don't think Israel would have done any of this had October the 7th not happened. And I don't know that Israel goes into any military engagement without thinking, how is this going to end? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's the long-term plan?
Well, October the 7th was inevitable if Israel didn't do anything. And it was inevitable to happen over and over again. And, you know, the truth is that when we pulled every last man, woman, and child and exhumed the dead bodies of Jews buried in Gaza and took them out of Gaza, so it became Judenrein.
This is what, 2005?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And left the greenhouses and left the factories.
That's a terrible word, Judenrein. That's from the Nazis.
Correct. It was Jew-free zone, no Jews, because apparently Jews living in Judea is a provocation for violence. Okay, so and the whole world was pressuring Israel, create a Palestinian state, you're an illegal occupier of Gaza and all those false claims. So we took everyone out of Gaza. And then the world pumped billions of dollars into this tiny geographical location. And we knew and we saw our money was going to a designated terrorist group that was oppressing its civilians, you know, political murders and oppression, oppression of gays, oppression of women. It was a
headquarters under hospitals,
extreme Islamist enclave, and obviously they used the billions of dollars not to build, you know, subways, but to build subterranean tunnels so that the terrorist groups can use civilians as human shields. And this all happened under our nose, and we saw it happening. So what did we expect to happen? My concern is that the Iranians have proxies and terror proxies around the world. And we know that Hezbollah has sleeper cells in the United States and really the Muslim Brotherhood, which for some reason isn't being talked about as much as it should be, also was coordinated, you know, across European borders and within the United States and Canada. And they are just not going to go down lightly. This is a theological, religious war for them. They believe commanded.
Are you suggesting that we're going to see retaliatory terrorist attacks on?
Well, my fear
possibly is civilian
that
targets.
There would be. That is my fear. And Jews around the world, and American embassies around the world, and are on high alert. You know, just take a look at a Jewish school and how the children go with armed guards every day.
Even here in South Africa.
They're always on alert. And this is the sad reality that we live in. And so we need to get these terror proxies under control, mostly by going after their financing. So I think step one with this warfare is the actual military bombing. Step two now, and you can see people like Elise Stefanik, who's focusing on the banking,
right,
is the terror financing.
She's a U.S.
And going
congresswoman.
After the banking system that has supported, that Iran has used, and also, by the way, Qatar is using to support terror proxies around the world. And then go after the members of government in various states who have been working illegally together with the Iranian regime to allow for the infiltration of radicalization in their country.
Is that one of the reasons you're here? Because we've heard about this cozy relationship that South Africa has with the Iranians. And there are all kinds of speculative reports about Iranian money coming in here. Various members of our government and past members of our government who are very close to the Iranian regime. Have you discovered anything in that respect? And is there stuff that you're looking for? And have you got appointments to see people here that might give us a little more clarity around that?
Do you want to know what I ate for breakfast too?
No, I think that these are worthy considerations. I know that you are someone who gets to the bottom of these things.
Yeah,
and
so,
you're interested in the answers to these questions.
I don't know more than really what is publicly available.
Okay.
And I think that you and I both know that what is publicly available is exactly what you said, questions into relationship between the Iranian regime and the ANC. In particular, you know, when you have a constituency that is concerned with how they're going to get food on the table or how they're going to get their kids to school or how they're going to clothe them or are we going to have heat and running water. And all of a sudden, this group, ANC, that has an incredible history of anti-apartheid, turns around and, you know, reverses its mission and says, you know, we're not concerned anymore about what's happening within our borders. But now we're concerned with, you know, adjudicating a foreign conflict where a designated terrorist group has attacked civilians and we want to use the legal system in a lawfare manner to undermine Israel. It's obvious. So the question is why? Why the change of heart? Who is funding this? These are things that South African-based researchers are digging into and more is being found, which is disturbing. I do believe that those who are more well-equipped than I need to take a really good look at whether election laws had been violated. You live in a democracy with a wonderful constitution. We have citizen rights to freedom of information. And if there is a case, and it does seem to be that Iran was unlawfully involved in any type of activities here, it should be examined and explored what legal implications that has.
It's interesting that you bring up Elise Stefanik because she actually was in Congress. I think it was in a congressional hearing the other day. She mentioned MTN, which is one of our big telcos, and said that there are questionable activities which clearly the Americans also have some side of, because they, of course, control the SWIFT exchange of international currencies, and they can see what transactions may or may not have occurred, and they probably have more information than either you or I have. But she's very firmly shone the spotlight on the dealings that MTN, who have, you know, they've done business in Iran. I think MTN is the third biggest network there.
I think these banks have to be really careful, because the next step is obviously, once the military actions die down a bit, there's going to be huge government resources focusing on the banking system, but also focusing on individuals. There's been talk in the United States of potential sanctioning of banks and individuals. And I would just say that Iran, the IRGC as we knew it, is gone. And the Iranian influence is now going to wane. We have other entities like the Qatar Foundation International that's going around and doing slightly the same thing. But it's time for reconciliation, let's just say. And I know for a fact that there are members of Congress and there are American organizations and also South African organizations that are dedicated to ensuring consequences.
When you say reconciliation, we have a very different view of that word, but you actually mean let's reconcile the accounts.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Let's
see some consequences for bad behavior.
Okay, I want to talk about lawfare, because I think that this is also something that you are extremely well-versed in. I mean, you may even have coined the term. The lawfare project is an interesting thing all on its own, but I want to talk about what this means, what the word means, where it's been deployed, because it is kind of casually thrown around now, especially in American politics, as a pejorative in the case of any situation where the Republicans don't want something done and the Democrats do, or the Democrats don't want something done and the Republicans do. And then they accuse each other of lawfare as a way to kind of slow down judicial and extrajudicial processes. So what does it mean to you? And let's explain this from the ground up, as if you were trying to explain it to a child.
Well, I'm happy that you recognize that the term is a negative one.
Yeah.
Because when we first, you know, introduced, the term actually was Islamist lawfare that I coined with my book, Lawfare, the War Against Free Speech. Lawfare was a term itself that was coined by U.S. Major General Charles Dunlap in a Harvard Law Review essay, where he was reviewing a Chinese strategy also about, you know, if you can't defeat a military power on the battlefield, you need to engage in certain elements of asymmetric warfare, right? You see that in terrorism, right? So it's not army or military versus military in uniform. It's terrorists hiding behind civilians so that when the civilians are killed, they can accuse the other side of war crimes and hit them where it hurts in the forums, that they're then going to manipulate. Forums that were established to uphold international law are now being manipulated to undermine international law, because we have this moral confusion, especially when it comes to so-called Israel-Palestine. So the lawfare term, it really means the use of the law as a weapon of war. And I first really discovered this when I released my film, The Making of a Martyr, a documentary film where I risked my life to go to Jenin, Ramallah, Tulkarm, and Nablus in order to expose what I believe to be one of the greatest crimes against humanity, which is the indoctrination and recruitment of innocent Muslim children towards violence, to be child soldiers, to be used as child suicide bombers and as human shields. And for 2 years, I documented how children were being recruited by designated terrorist groups and being blown up, sometimes by remote control. And what I noticed after I released the film is everybody who was doing what I was doing, which was going on the media and talking publicly and writing about the threat of radical Islam, three things started happening. Number one, they started getting physically and violently attacked. Recall the firebombing of Charlie Hebdo offices for the now infamous Danish cartoon with a bomb in his turban. The murder of Theo van Gogh. He was stabbed on the back on the streets of Amsterdam. His last words were, "Can we talk about this?" for doing a film called Submission about the treatment of women under Islam. And we all started getting slandered and sued, called Islamophobic, or finding ourselves on the receiving end of this frivolous lawsuits that are designed to shut us up, right? So, for example, I represented counterterrorism personnel who were sued by the very terror front organizations they were testifying against, which is insane. there was a famous lawsuit that my former boss was involved in where 17 media defendants were sued by the Islamic Society of Boston for uncovering the fact that Saudi funds were going in to radicalize the mosque. And lo and behold, the two Boston bombers were allegedly radicalized at this mosque, but because they were sued, the FBI shut down the investigation and nobody talked about it anymore because they were in the middle of a lawsuit. So lawfare is designed really as an intimidation tool to stop us from talking about these issues. And then you have it on the global scale. You have lawfare against Israel, lawfare against the United States. It was actually found in England that they captured Al-Qaeda manuals that instructed captured prisoners to file false claims of torture so they could reposition themselves in the eyes of the media and the world as human rights victims. That was actually one of the strategies in the Al-Qaeda manual. You have, you know, war crimes charges against Israeli officials so they can't land in the UK without fear of an arrest warrant. But Hamas and Hezbollah cross European borders and apparently bank in European banks with total impunity, right? That's not justice. That's lawfare. When you have an International Court of Justice's opinion that that a barrier, a security barrier that Israel builds out of brick and mortar is a violation of international law, but then the same court refuses to enter into evidence the very real fact that the fence contributed to a sharp decline in the loss of human lives, refused to enter into evidence the testimony of Muslim, Christian, Jewish terror victims. That's not justice. That is lawfare. That is manipulation of the legal system for warfare purposes. So that's what I wrote my first book on.
I think it's such a useful catch-all term, but again, that's been perverted too.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, the people who work with this and use lawfare as their primary tool for intimidation are also now using other people's very clear definitions of this and twisting that to mean something completely different. So it's almost been watered down. You know, it's like in South Africa, I often say that we've got a major gender-based violence problem. We've got a huge amount of rape and abuse of women that happens. But then in America, we had like the Me Too movement, which had the effect of taking small infractions and making them large, and taking large infractions and minimizing them so that they were all the same. And what it did is it watered down the category.
Yes, and it made the women's rights movement completely meaningless because hashtag MeToo had more to do with virtue signaling against
Trump. Oscar-winning actresses who were cross about not getting a trophy versus people who live in absolute fear every day.
Right, or using a legitimate cause and politicizing it making it really about, I hate Trump.
So there's that. There's the perversion of the law for the purposes of, as you say, non-military aggression,
to complement military aggression, right? So the perfect example is you have Hamas intentionally putting its headquarters in a so-called hospital, which is just pretty much a building that says hospital written on it. There aren't 36 hospitals in Gaza. That would mean there's a hospital every 2 square miles. There's a hospital every 100 square miles in the United States. Like, it's not feasible.
Well, this leads me on to the next question, which is about the PR impact of this. And whenever I speak to people who are thoughtful and have taken the time and trouble to actually pay attention to the information that comes out of both sides, I hate saying the both sides of the conflict, because to me it's not as straightforward as that either. These people who ask, why is it that Israel is losing the PR war? Because their opinion of the situation is probably due to, again, them watching really bad news actors. But they believe that Israel is losing the PR war. They believe that Israel looks like it's morally and in terms of touchy-feely things, being pilloried. They see Israel as the loser in that part of the argument. How do you respond to that, and what can we do about it? Because it's clearly a perversion of the information and of emotional manipulation.
Mm-hmm. For sure, absolutely, and it's one of the oldest tricks in the book, right? It's a blood libel that is amplified through social media and through the news to have the effect of dehumanizing the Jew and rationalizing violence, resistance by all means, for example, and then virtue signaling off that. But I hate when people say, no offense, you know, Israel has such bad PR, as though it is Israel's responsibility to engage in a PR campaign to make everybody love it.
Yeah.
Right? I just don't think that's the case.
No other countries are required to do that.
No, and you know, I say to students that come to me, I say to them, you have no responsibility to engage in pro-Israel advocacy. You don't have a responsibility to make people love Israel, but you do have a responsibility to stand up for yourself as a Jew, as a minority, if you are being targeted and
just
harassed and discriminated against.
How about that?
Right.
You know, just
but
as someone who likes the truth.
We had a huge lost opportunity. There was a strategic campaign, which I call the Islamophobomania campaign, okay, which started back around 9/11, which was the three-pronged strategy of physical attacks, lawfare lawsuits, and slandering anyone who spoke publicly about the very real threat of radically motivated terrorism as a shared threat that is faced between all Western democracies, not just Israel's problem. Right.
I will never forget Christopher Hitchens saying, stand up to this nonsense while you still have the chance.
Right.
While you still can.
Right. So this Islamophobomania campaign got so perverted that there was a police unit in Britain, I think it was the British Midlands Police Force, that knew about a child sex trafficking ring with Pakistani Muslims for 15 years. Young girls and boys were murdered and drugged and trafficked and the most horrific things. They knew about it, but they refused to do anything about it out of fear of being called Islamophobic, which is the greatest irony and frankly, insult to the Muslim population. If I risked my life to make a film about Muslim children, arguing Muslim children deserve to live, they don't deserve to have bombs strapped around their waist and to be blown up by remote control.
Right.
If that's anti-Islam, right? What is pro-Islam?
Right.
If it's anti-Muslim to help little children who are being abused, what then is pro-Muslim? And isn't that the bigotry of low expectations? And for too long, we have responded to anti-Jewish discrimination and also appeasement of radicalization and terrorism with pro-Israel advocacy, as though our goal, okay, is now to make people love the state of Israel. Our goal should be to make people fear radicalization, to have an interfaith allyship between Jews and the Jewish state and black Christians that are being slaughtered just on our borders with Mozambique by the same terrorist groups that are slaughtering Jews and other minorities in Israel. And that is the message. And people shy away from that message because they're afraid and because it's negative campaigning and it's not feel-good campaigning. But negative campaigning works because when people need to care. People care about themselves, right? Why should I expect anyone, especially living in South Africa, to give a hoot about what's going on in Israel or love the politicians? They've never been there. Like, why are we asking them to love a foreign state? But they care about their children. They care about if there's a direct physical threat on their children. They care about the poorest borders here in South Africa and whether or not we have terror sleeping cells that are going to start blowing up Christian churches and Jewish synagogues, God forbid. Yeah. These are issues that we can all agree on and refocus the attention on what it needs to be, which is how to get rid of the threat of radical Islam and then how to reverse and stop the hate education system that now they're bringing here. And that's what they mean when they say globalize the intifada. It starts with hate education. The Nazis knew this well. In order to get otherwise average people to turn into monsters and justify the killing and murdering of other civilians as though it's required, you have to dehumanize the other. And when you globalize the intifada, they're globalizing the type of hate education that's needed to dehumanize the Jews, dehumanize the infidels, and prepare for violence. And this is what concerns me.
What also concerns me, I couldn't agree more. Everything you've just said, people should play on repeat or at least listen to again, because I think you articulate it better than anyone else. The other thing that worries me, of course, is back in America, on college campuses, it's become very cool. It's become en vogue to be blatantly anti-Semitic. We see a rise of anti-Semitism, the like of which I certainly haven't in my adult life. I'm very, very concerned about the fact that it has become, you know, there's this morphing of this kind of omni-cause in America. And by omni-cause, I mean the climate change people allied with the LGBTQI people, allied with the Free Palestine people, are now also the Free Iran people. They definitely don't like Jews, and they definitely are opposed to capitalism, to liberty, to liberal democracy. This is a dangerous and growing coalition of people who have grievances with various groups, but they all seem to be pretty sure about the fact that they don't like Jews. What's going on there?
Right. And I mean, everything that you said is going on there and worse. There are mass radicalization on our campuses. This is something that has been going on for at least the last 15 to 20 years. Those of us in the counterterrorism community who have been calling this out for the last 15 years have been slandered and marginalized as, you named it, Islamophobic. And when President Trump and the Trump administration started to take care of the problem, what's so disturbing is that you have the radical left media coming out against him. And it's insane. How could anyone be against deporting someone who not only lied on their visa about their connections to a designated terrorist group, but then came to our country on a student visa, which is a privilege, it's not a right, engaged in mass civil rights violations, organizes mass assaults, trespass, advocates for terrorist groups. We have every right as a country to deport these people, and yet you have activist judges and you have the insane media who are arguing against this as though they have a First Amendment constitutional right to engage in lawlessness. I mean, this is law school 101. Your rights end where my rights start. You do not have a constitutional free speech right to engage in unlawful criminal activity. And if we are so morally confused that we cannot delineate between the two, then I think we have a problem. And the other problem we have is the massive amounts of funding coming in from Qatar. $1 billion a year funding American education, critical race theory, so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion departments, Middle Eastern studies departments, opening up campuses for schools of journalism in Qatar so that they can, you know, radicalize our journalists and then send them back to CNN. I call this, you know, the greatest systemic influence campaign this world has ever seen. And thank God for President Trump, who's starting to do something about it. And even with the campus agitators, we have paid agitators. The FBI released a report showing that Iran was financially assisting paid agitators to come on our campuses.
There are lots of people who seem to be funding paid agitators. It happens in this country too. I don't know who is paying them because the lackluster and sad group of people who gather around the U.S. embassy or consulate every time there's something in the news that they think they can get some attention for, people in kafirs arrive out of nowhere, and you can't tell me it's not coordinated, and you can't tell me that they're not doing it because they're being paid. I just wish we could find out who these people are. Are we getting any closer to discovering? You mentioned Qatar just now, who've played a very interesting game here. Qatar are trying to be friends with America, but at the same time infiltrate America and do huge damage to America from within. And we heard Trump saying, the great emir of Qatar, he's a great guy, he's my friend, we're very good friends, we've got a base there. I mean, what's actually going on here? Because are they trying to dupe both?
Well, I'll answer that in a second. I want to go back to the masks.
Yeah,
protesters.
Sure. Always masked.
We started a campaign in the United States that has taken on called Unmask Hate, where we are working for legislation to be enforced when it's on the books or to close the loopholes to make it illegal you know, in the commission of a crime to conceal your identity. And when those laws are enforced, we see a lot less of those, you know, concealed protesters. And that might be an opportunity here. The other thing, my understanding is you don't have national origin discrimination prescribed in your anti-discrimination laws. I think that's something to improve. And really, we have to look to close the loopholes of what allows this to happen. But look, first of all, that was a really good impression of Trump. I'm very impressed. But yeah,
it's getting better.
Qatar is sucking and blowing at the same time, and it's doing so with extraordinarily skill and capability. Yeah. And they are so moneyed up.
Yeah, they got.
And they
lots
are
of
just
money.
Buying right. up everything and buying up influence and spreading their radical ideology, you know, unfettered, except for. My understanding, in only one case, and that's with the lawsuit that the Lawfare Project filed against Carnegie Mellon University, which is the third largest recipient of funds from Qatar. What we know is that CMU received over $800 million in outsized donations from Qatar, which no doubt were then used to radicalize the population and is responsible for the over 300% rise on campus of Jew hatred and radicalization. So while we cannot stop the flow, the tsunami of money coming in from Qatar as a civil society, and particularly with this one lawsuit, at the very least, we can stop the money from being used illegally. And that's what we intend to do with this lawsuit.
It's amazing to me how the campuses have become the ignition switch for all of this. But there's a rise in global anti-Semitism, which has in Europe been a problem for a long time. I don't know. I'm sure you do. I don't know if some people in the audience might not know this, but I thought Benjamin Netanyahu, who you know, comes under criticism sometimes, I think, fairly, sometimes very unfairly from people, as if they think there's someone else who could have done a better job during this very difficult time. But he said something a while ago. He might not even have been prime minister at the time he said it, linking a lot of what we see in Europe when it comes to, you know, oh, God, we don't want to be accused of Islamophobia, which harkens all the way back to the Holocaust. And there's kind of a guilt situation that hasn't been dealt with properly. And psychologists may have a better time of this than I will. But I thought that a speech that he made once on that subject did help me to understand quite a lot about the anti-Semitism that still persists in Europe. But in America, you know, this is quite novel in America. There have always been people who hate Jews, just like there have been people who hate blacks, and there have been people who hate whites, and there have been people who hate rich people, and God knows what else all over the world. But there's something especially ugly and nefarious about anti-Semitism, which I think Douglas Murray explains very well based on what he heard from, I think it was, I don't want to misquote him here, but he basically says, you know, you can hate the Jews because they don't have a state, then you can hate them because they do have a state.
Yeah.
You can hate them because they're religious, but then you can hate them because they're secular. You can hate them because they stick together, or you can hate them because they don't. They live apart and they do different things. You can hate them because there are outward symbols of their perhaps, you know, very devout and orthodox religion. Or you can hate them because they're trying to hide it. You can hate them because of what they do and because of what they don't do. And so on. The list goes on. You can find a reason. It was Grossman that he was quoting.
Well, yeah, I think it was a summary of Dennis Prager's definition of what is Jew hatred, which is, you know, when Jews are communists, you know, the capitalists hate them.
When the society is capitalist,
Jews are being accused of being communists.
It was Vasily Grossman, though, who said that he was explaining how anti-Semitism comes to be, and he said this interesting thing, which is, if you want to know what someone is guilty of, ask them what they hate about the Jews.
It's this mirror effect, right, that the enemies of the free world and of the Jewish state always accuse Israel of what they are guilty of. Mm-hmm. It's the mirror effect. Yeah. And, you know, Robert Greene in his book 48 Laws of Power actually has a whole chapter about it. And it's so perverted, especially in the so-called Israeli-Palestinian context, that the entire foundational story of the Jewish people has been mirrored and inverted, right? There was an indigenous people in a land in the Middle East who were subject to colonialism, occupation, and genocide, who then the world recognized their right to a state, but that recognition and borders have never been fulfilled, and they've been denied their olive tree. You know, whose story is that? That's the Jewish story. Even the term, and that's now been used and perverted because in the 1970s, Yasser Arafat, who was an Egyptian, he's not Palestinian. Yeah. There's no such thing as an exclusive Muslim Palestinian identity, right? Yasser Arafat, who was an Egyptian, invented this new Arab nationality of Palestinian solely so that he could claim legal parity with the Jews in international courts and in the media for title to the land. And this exclusive Muslim identity is historical revisionism of a Palestinian. I'm Palestinian. My ancestors are Palestinian. Jews identified together with Muslims and Christians, and frankly, anyone who lived in Palestine as Palestinian because it was a geographical location.
Right.
My ancestors has Palestine stamped on their passports. The Jerusalem Post used to be called the Palestine Post. The Israel Orchestra used to be called the Palestinian Orchestra. And then when the establishment of Israel came into being, we changed our passports and it became the State of Israel. So this whole notion that Jews are not indigenous to Judea, if Jews are not from Judea, Italians are from Italy, Chinese people from China, Jews are from Judea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing that they want to deny us. They want to the world to think that Jews are from nowhere, right? Jews are not from Europe. Jews are not from Judea. And then where does the Jew have the place to live on this planet, if that's the case? And that is the ultimate goal. And they use lawfare, they use the mirror image effect to create this insane Orwellian upside down narrative where truth is false and what's false is true, and where a terrorist literally hiding its bombs under a maternity ward of a hospital is the victim of a crime versus the civilians that they are using as human shields. And then just, I also want to talk about the complete redefinition of legal terms like proportionality.
Yeah.
Right? Proportionality doesn't mean, you know, if you kill five Palestinians, you can only kill five Jews or vice versa. And actually Douglas Murray said this well. He's like, well, what then would be the proportional response to mass rape and burning women and children alive? Is that what we should then go do to the other side? Is that proportional? The definition of proportionality in international law is that you can only use as much threat as necessary to completely extinguish the threat. So if someone comes to you with a knife, you use a gun to extinguish the threat.
Correct.
That's what proportionality means, and that's exactly what Israel's been doing. Israel goes above and beyond even what is required by the laws of armed conflict. You don't have to warn the terrorists with leaflets before you're coming. You don't have to do a knock on the roof so, you know, civilians would exit. When those civilians, by the way, there are videos that came out showing civilians running away from a facility that the Israelis warned they're going to attack, which was being used by Hamas to store weapons, and Hamas taking out by sniper fire any of the civilians who were running away.
I'm not going to let you go before we talk about free speech and hate speech, because mm-hmm. the definitions are, for some people, quite complicated, and I think we need to have a very clear idea of what we're talking about here in order to have a society where these mean anything at all. We don't have a First Amendment in South Africa. The First Amendment in the United States allows for free expression of most kinds. Obviously, you mentioned earlier where your rights start infringing on someone else's. That's where it becomes hairy. Hate speech is much more complicated because the definition of hate speech, even in our law, is words and thoughts and written stuff that will incite people to violence, but that is also hateful in its content. And when you get to hateful content, that's where it's kind of a gray area, because hateful content could just be what some comedians get away with. after all, isn't every joke at someone's expense? And then right up to propaganda designed to dehumanize somebody. Mm-hmm. And we have a history in this country of precisely that, to a degree that we're perhaps as sensitive as maybe people who are studying anti-Semitism maybe. So what are your guidelines in terms of trying to find a way to make this useful in the application of the law and for people to understand what the limits of, mm-hmm. if there are any, if there should be any, free speech might be?
Well, I don't think there should be one guideline for the whole world. I think that the free speech and hate speech laws that have been developed in different countries have been developed differently because of the history of those countries. So while the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution might be very appropriate for the United States because of our history, it perhaps is not so appropriate for Israel or not appropriate for Germany, right? So we're in the United States. You're free to be a bigot. You can say, I hate Jews. You can even say, I want to kill all the Jews, as long as it's not incitement to immediate violence. And if you want, we can discuss what that's all about. You can stand on a corner with a sign. But what you can't do is speech then plus action. Action that harasses or targets someone.
Okay. I think you and I probably agree then.
But yeah. In Germany, for example, because of their unique history, their constitution or Bill of Rights, whatever it is, should probably support the banning of certain types of speech and potentially assembly and organization under particular political parties. Or maybe in Israel, you know, why should Israel tolerate a mosque where a radical imam is preaching death to the Jews every day next to a kindergarten school after October the 7th? Yeah. Whereas in the United States, that would be protected speech.
Right.
So there's no, you know, silver bullet.
Right.
But... Okay. Yeah, so there's a tension, obviously, between the two. And I happen to align as a free speech purist. And in my book, I wrote about it, Lawfare, the War Against Free Speech. You know, no matter how offensive what you're saying is, the truth must be told, especially about controversial issues. And obviously, the controversial issue of the day at that time when I was writing the book, and I think still relevant today, is radical theologically motivated Islamist terrorism. And the last thing, you know, the problem, if you were to think about hate speech laws, is you never know what's offensive until after you say it. So you can't really have a free society if people are going around suing based on their hurt feelings. So if you're going to have hate speech laws, you have to be able to draft them in a way is that when you enter into society, you're going to know what is allowed and what is not allowed, right? The Danish cartoon of Muhammad with a bomb, that is satire. Is that hate speech? Or are we going to restrict it to, again, incitement to immediate violence based on a group because of their race or ethnicity? The latter, I think, would be obviously a smarter law.
Yeah, well, I think you've said it pretty much in the best way possible. It's always going to be a case-by-case basis. And I think it's very hard to determine the intention of the person who's saying the thing, because sometimes their intention is to make people laugh. Sometimes their intention is malicious in the extreme and malevolent. And it's hard for you to get in someone's head and figure out precisely what they're trying to do when they say or think something. Especially think, and we don't want thought police.
Right.
But the ability to say something, even the very worst thing, at least allows the people around you to make decisions based on what you've said and what you think.
Right, and let's say what your position is.
Sure.
What if you're a political leader in a stadium with 10,000 people chanting what you're chanting, and then they all go out and somebody gets killed? You have a different responsibility as a political leader than you do, I don't know, a comedian standing on stage trying to make light of the issue so that we can talk about it.
Yeah, I think this will continue to be a very, very complicated thing to talk about, and particularly where people are extremely sensitive. For good or bad reasons. I don't know that there are bad reasons to be sensitive. And I think it's just great that you're doing the work that you're doing. I'm glad that you're in South Africa. I hope that you have a very good time here in between all the extremely important work that you're doing. And thanks for coming to spend some time with us.
Thank you for having me. It's really been quite the pleasure. I've been looking forward to meeting you for quite some time.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's very nice. Thank you. Same goes my way. Thank you, everybody. We will see you on Friday at 6 a.m.